what is it about Manning Clark that attracts such attention? There have been other historians of greater accomplishment. Keith Hancock, for instance, I think had a wider range and sharper judgment. There have been professors of history who've exercised a greater influence on the discipline and the profession, such as Max Crawford, who taught Clark and first employed him to teach Australian history and subsequently tried to reassure him that he was not an outcast. And there have been finer writers of history. Geoffrey Blainey would surely rank high on a list of prose stylists. But none of them approach Clark's celebrity. Let me just remind you, he was Australian of the Year in 1981. He was the subject of a stage musical in the bicentenary year. We have someone who's offering to sing songs from it. And of extraordinary tributes in the Federal Parliament when he died in 1991. He was an instantly recognisable figure in public life, constantly sought by the media and seldom refusing their requests. One reason for Clark's celebrity, I think, was that he cultivated it. Quite early in life, he became convinced that he was marked for greatness. And those of you who've read Puzzles of Childhood, the first volume of his autobiography, will recall that he tells there a story, and he told it many times. He remembered his mother telling him, as he sat in the backyard of his parents' house before he was five, and saying, "Man, dear, you're a very special boy. There's nothing you can't do if you want to do it." Now, since my mother's in the audience, I should say that many of us enjoy such maternal encouragement, but few of us take it so literally. Mind you, seldom of us have a mother of such adamantine will or a father of such troubled uncertainty as Manning Clark. This passage in Clark's memoirs has been quoted recently by one of his biographers, Mark McKenna, and I'm sure a number of you will have followed the story of Mark McKenna's discovery that Clark placed himself in the German city of Bonn 15 or 16 days too soon. He stated repeatedly that he arrived there from Oxford to join his fiancée, Dimpfner, on the morning of the 10th of November 1938, immediately following the rampage of destruction against Jews that's come to be known as Kristallnacht. And this became one of his great moments of epiphany when he witnessed and grasped a great truth, in this case the capacity for human evil. And Mark McKenna has documented that Clark didn't in fact arrive in Bonn until the 26th of November, and that much of what he told about that terrible event was taken from Dimpfner. Mark McKenna explains this appropriation as a product of Clark's need to inhabit the past, to be present in it, to speak with a unique insight. And he explains it, I think, as an example of Clark's personal voice, the voice of the heart and the mind that was seeking higher truths. And it is true that voices spoke to Clark, voices within him, voices from the past, voices from the present. And he was determined to speak them back to us, mediated through his unique emotional intelligence and sensibility. McKenna, in his story of Kristallnacht and how he deals with it, is drawing on a biography of Manning Clark that he's writing and expects to finish next year, and this publication of his excerpt in the monthly stimulated an extended essay in the Australian Book Review from Brian Matthews, who's also writing a biography of Clark. And I think that essay grapples with some insight into the same problem of Manning Clark's self-dramatisation. And there have been earlier accounts of Clark's life and career. There have been a number of books discussing his work. He's attracted by a considerable measure greater commentary than any other Australian historian. One reason for that, I think, is the extraordinary antagonism he provoked. The appearance of the first volume of his history in 1962 produced widely divergent responses and indeed led to the organisation of a national seminar by the Australian Association for Cultural Freedom. That was an anti-communist product of the Cold War that was in fact initiated and financed by the United States Central Intelligence Agency, but it was an organisation with which Clark was then associated. 14 years later, the invitation that Manning Clark delivered the Boyer Lectures aroused conservative fury. Can a guarantee be given, a Liberal senator asked, that Professor Manning Clark will not use his power to stop other historians from getting paper, to have their pencils broken so that they cannot write, and to have them sent to a leftist, fascist, gulag archipelago? And from this point, from 75-76, both Quadrant, which was the journal of the Association for Cultural Freedom, and Rupert Murdoch's Australian, kept up a recurrent denigration. 2 years after he died, his publisher and former friend, Peter Ryan, came forth with a remarkable denunciation. From anecdotes and intimacies, Ryan built up a portrait of a man who was guilty of bad faith and wrote bad history. We now know that Ryan had become deeply antagonistic to the author, in fact, who maintained the viability of Melbourne University Press, but Ryan clearly lacked the integrity to declare his feelings and waited until Clark was dead before doing so. And you can imagine how that might happen. Even so, the duplicity of publicly promoting his prize author while privately encouraging hostile reviews, as the records of Melbourne University Press demonstrate he did, is breathtaking. In 1996, the Courier Mail gave over 8 pages of its weekend edition to the allegation that Clark was, and I quote, an undiscovered member of the communist world elite. And they went on to explain that he was also a prized agent of influence, possibly a spy, and in any case, the holder of the Soviet Union's highest order, the Order of Lenin. Now, those charges soon collapsed, and the Press Council admonished the Courier Mail and its editor, Chris Mitchell. But Chris Mitchell is now the editor of The Australian, from where he's kept up this vendetta. When Dimphna Clark complained about the abuse of her dead husband, she was told, just wait, we've yet to run the story about his homosexuality. And that was one of the canards that Peter Ryan had promoted but hadn't been prepared to publish. He still talks about it to those who want to talk to him about Manning Clark. In response to the Courier Mail story, which was taken up by the Murdoch Press around the country, the new Prime Minister said he'd always had a less than rapturous view of the Manning Clark view of Australian history, and he found the cultural rapture of the left for it rather nauseating. It's too negative, John Howard explained. The egregious Alexander Downer announced that Clark's history would be removed from the libraries of American embassies. So much, I thought at the time, for the new government's declared goal of liberating us from political correctness. And the obsession continues. In his 2006 Australia Day speech on the need to revive interest in Australian history, the Prime Minister also said that it needed to be freed from the baleful influence of Manning Clark. In a later speech to mark the 50th anniversary of Quadrant, he condemned Clark again as an apologist for the Soviet Union and communism. I've written extensively about Manning Clark, both as Clark as a historian and Clark as the public figure. I'm one of those readers who was drawn to his history, and I'm also one of the people who's affronted by his treatment, especially the posthumous treatment. Like most who knew him, I have warm memories of his friendship. He was a very hospitable, interested, encouraging man, and I have reservations about his frailties. He was beset by self-doubt and he could be both snide and portentous. I certainly admire his writing and respond to it, but I've never regarded him as a model. And indeed, the few historians who have attempted to imitate Manning Clark have been embarrassments. One of the persistent myths about him is the proposition that he led the Australian historical profession into a false, gloomy view of the nation's past, so that historians now enforce a left-wing interpretation in universities, they propagate it in schools, they employ it in public commentary to denigrate the Australian achievement. You catch this in an incomplete form in Geoffrey Blainey's reference to the influence of Clark's Old Testament phrases in the lecture that Geoffrey Blainey delivered to Quadrant in 1993 that coined the term black armband history. And you certainly see it in the subsequent uses of that phrase by John Howard. And you see something of the same conspiratorial mind at work in Keith Windchuttle's denunciation of what he calls an orthodox school of historians who are meant to have fabricated a genocidal history of Aboriginal massacres. Those allegations against Clark are as fanciful as the claim that he was a Soviet agent. He did not generate the radical revision of Australian history, which came in the 1970s when he was well into his six-volume history. On the contrary, he acknowledged subsequently that he'd failed to do justice to the concerns of this new generation of historians with class, gender, race, discrimination and exclusion. And he tried, I think mostly unsuccessfully, to incorporate workers and women and Aboriginals and migrants and oppressed minorities into his final volumes. His artistic, literary and religious sensibility was quite different from my generation of historians, and he had little time for the interests and institutional practices of the academic profession. He was never a left-wing historian. On the contrary, he defined himself as an observer of the great clash of ideologies that gave his History of Australia its tragic grandeur. In each volume, he would trace the endeavours of men of vision, and sometimes women, who are shown as trying to impose their will on the land and the people. These actors embody the great systems of belief that give purpose to human life, but they're invariably flawed individuals, and their schemes of redemption are doomed. In the early volumes, the principal impulses were Catholicism, Protestantism, and the Enlightenment. And it's certainly from the Enlightenment that the left takes its values of secular reason and social progress. But that triad of ideologies expands in the middle volumes to include a sense of place. Hence the land boys we live in and the earth which abideth forever, key phrases in those volumes. And the scheme, I think, is arguably simplified in the final volumes to a clash between what he calls the old dead tree of British values and European culture and the young green tree of nationalist Australia. Now, both those are boreal tropes, the old dead tree and the young green tree, are in fact taken from Henry Lawson. But Lawson was variously a socialist, a republican, a racist, a militarist, I sound a bit like Humphrey McQueen here, and a misogynist, and his short stories and poems are hardly attuned to present-day sensibilities. Some of you will have heard Don Watson's rather depressing prediction that Lawson will never again be a popular Australian writer. Those themes that run through his history are apparent to anyone who takes the trouble to read them. Although the sympathies of the author are always complicated by his habit of speaking through the various contending heroic actors. R.W. Connell described this as a ventriloquist method, the way in which he very seldom speaks directly, but it's always through those actors. And it's one of the ways in which I think Clark transcends the dichotomy of right and left. He has his sympathies, certainly. He's noticeably unfair to Alfred Deakin and Robert Menzies, but he cannot share the hopes of even his most sympathetic characters. On all of them, he looks eventually with the eye of pity. As I say, this elementary point that Clark is not a left-wing historian has been frequently made and just as frequently ignored. And so rather than reiterate it here tonight, I want to spend the rest of my time demonstrating it. I thought I could do so by reference to Manning Clark's relationship to another and indisputably left-wing historian, Brian Fitzpatrick. Now, looking at the audience and without wanting to insult them, there are probably quite a few people who have memories of Brian Fitzpatrick. Is that right? I can see someone nodding. Brian Fitzpatrick was a freelance radical scholar and civil libertarian. He was for about 30 years, in fact, Secretary of the Australian Council of Civil Liberties. He made a significant contribution to Australian history with three books that appeared in rapid succession in 1939, 1940, 1941. The first two, entitled, rather confusingly, I think, for people who try to remember them, one was called The British Imperialism in Australia and the other was called The British Empire in Australia. And they were large-scale books in sequence that dealt with the establishment and development of capitalism in Australia. The third, published in 1941, was A Short History of the Australian Labour Movement that was written quite deliberately for a working class audience with a political intent. And those books, along with others, I think established, were fundamental to what came to be known as the radical nationalist interpretation of Australian history. There are others who contributed to it, but Fitzpatrick was undoubtedly foundational. Brian Fitzpatrick was 10 years older than Manning Clark. He was born in 1905, raised in the lower class Melbourne suburb of Moonee Ponds. From the local state school and then from Essendon High, he won a scholarship to the University of Melbourne and a further residential scholarship to Trinity College, the Anglican college of the university. He was active in student life. He helped to found both the Labor Club and the student newspaper, Farrago. He did well in his studies, well enough to obtain a free passage to postgraduate research in England in 1926, but already he was more interested in writing and radicalism and roistering. So he returned in 1927, with no research completed, to journalism in Sydney and a brief marriage to the historian Kathleen Fitzpatrick. Kathleen Pitt she was when he met her as an undergraduate. And that took him back in the early 1930s to Melbourne, where he became a feature writer for Keith Murdoch in the Herald. That in turn ended, his marriage had long since ended, in 1936 when he gave up the career as a journalist to pursue historical research and to campaign for civil liberties. There were periods of employment. For about 2 years he had financial assistance as a research fellow at the University of Melbourne. For about 18 months he worked for the wartime Labor government. But his opportunities were restricted, particularly for someone of his bohemian lifestyle, and the onset of the Cold War after 1945 reduced them further. Furthermore, by this time he'd remarried and he had a family to support. The books that he produced after the war were lively and opinionated, but I think it's fair to say they lacked the substance, the scholarly rigour, and indeed the impact of his earlier work. He was essentially unemployed, despite occasional poorly paid and demeaning casual jobs. He would frequently, for instance, invigilate in public examinations, and he was also a mail sorter. But he did, from time to time, seek academic employment. He was invariably rejected and he was increasingly disturbed and depressed by his rejection. However, until his sudden death from a stroke in 1965, he remained true to his beliefs and steadfast in his loyalties. Put alongside that the career of Manning Clark, born 10 years later, of course. He came from the other side of Melbourne, most immediately from the Bluestone boarding house at Melbourne Grammar in South Yarra. But he too made his way to university and indeed to Melbourne Grammar by means of scholarships. He too took up residence at Trinity College to begin an arts degree. Like Fitzpatrick, he was probably more closely drawn to literature than he was to history, but he decided eventually to concentrate his studies on history. He also won a scholarship that took him to England, and he too failed to complete a degree there. For 3 years, after his return, he taught at Geelong Grammar. Now, there's a significant difference. When Brian Fitzpatrick came back, he was living in the demimonde of King's Cross. Manning Clark was living as a boarding master at Geelong Grammar. While there, he completed a thesis on Alexis de Tocqueville that he'd begun at Oxford but not completed. And for that he achieved the degree of Master of Arts. In 1944 he began teaching in the Political Science Department at the University of Melbourne. In 1946 he transferred to the History Department and began teaching Australian history. And in 1949 he was appointed to the Foundation Chair of History at the Canberra University College, as it then was. It amalgamated with the research-based Australian National University in 1960. And it was while there as a professor of history in Canberra that he conceived and wrote the first three volumes in his History of Australia. The final three volumes appeared after his retirement from the chair in 1975. The two men, Manning Clark and Brian Fitzpatrick, became friends and drinking companions when Clark returned to Melbourne in the 1940s. their common friend, the historian Don Baker, who died sadly earlier this year. Don Baker remarked, and I'm quoting him, "With the possible exception of Brian Fitzpatrick, Manning was the most entertaining drinker I've ever met." They maintained the friendship after Clark moved to Canberra in 1949, and it came to be reinforced by family connections. Clark developed a close relationship with Brian Fitzpatrick's estranged first wife, Kathleen, but he also took a keen interest in the two children of the second marriage, especially David Fitzpatrick, a distinguished Irish historian. And David Fitzpatrick dedicated probably his greatest work, Oceans of Consolation, published in 1994, to the memory of Brian Fitzpatrick and Manning Clark. And Brian Fitzpatrick's daughter, Sheila, became a close friend of Manning Clark's daughter, Katerina. They're born within a month of each other. They met as undergraduates. Both of them hold distinguished chairs in the United States, Sheila in Russian history and Katerina in Russian literature. The two men were dissidents. Both turned to history in search of a new understanding that they hoped would allow Australians to come to terms with their past, to throw off their subservience, redeem past wrongs, and take charge of their destinies. Both of them were activists who used the public platform to challenge conventional beliefs. Both of them were difficult men who sometimes tried the patience of their friends with unconventional behaviour. Fitzpatrick, I think, was the most assured and certainly the most gregarious. He was a stocky man with rough features, but a courtly manner and considerable charm. He was a very lively raconteur who could behave outrageously when drunk. Clark was more sensitive, grave in appearance and demeanour, I think capable of warm human sympathy, but also of innuendo. And he too relied, certainly in the first part of his life, relied on alcohol to release inhibition, often with disastrous results. He refers to this usually as having a fit of the sillies. But the two men were also heading in different directions. When Clark gave his inaugural professorial lecture in Canberra, and it was a very delayed one, it occurred nearly 5 years after he'd taken up the chair, he chose as the title of his inaugural professorial lecture, Rewriting Australian History. And he used that lecture really to declare his break from the left nationalist interpretation of Australian history. Naturally, in order to do so, he had to explain why he disagreed with Fitzpatrick, and he described Fitzpatrick as a disappointed radical. He said he thought of the past as a vast manure heap to fertilise the soil for some future harmony which Labour would complete. He said that Fitzpatrick had become disillusioned by corruption, opportunism, the failure of the Labour movement in his own time, and because of that had created the illusion of a lost golden age back in the past when Labour was pure, untainted by the world, the flesh and the devil. Now, it took some years, and indeed the occasion was a review article that was provoked by the appearance of a book organised by the Association for Cultural Freedom to which Manning Clark had contributed. It took that for Fitzpatrick to reply in print. And in a long review article, he emphatically denied that he'd ever believed in a lost golden age or that he was a disillusioned radical. I quote him, "Only idealists, fools and unprincipled careerists become disappointed radicals, and even then they seldom celebrate their disappointment by undertaking a considerable research." You sort of catch some of Fitzpatrick's style here. He derided Clark's lecture, and I'm quoting him again, "such a farrago of false premises, misstatements of fact, prime instances of the fallacies of non sequitur, petitio principi, and the undistributed middle, as would give pleasurable excitement for hours to an English expression class, set the passage for a clear thinking exercise." Clear thinking had just been introduced into matriculation English in Victorian schools. And as for Clark, he said he was full of great oaths and bearded like the pard. Manning had only recently started wearing the beard, and said that he had initiated his campaign to rewrite Australian history with a flight of splenetic arrows. Now, how might we understand this exchange of polemics? Well, I think to understand Manning Clark's ostentatious abandonment of the left, we need to bear in mind that he'd fallen under Cold War suspicion after he took up his Canberra chair. He arrived in Canberra 2 months before the federal election that brought Robert Menzies to office, and a principal election issue was the Cold War. He'd lost as a result of some public statements his involvement in the training of diplomatic cadets. His home was under surveillance by ASIO. He was frequently observed by ASIO to be absent from home and seeking solace at the bar of the Hotel Civic. He was desperate to return to Melbourne, constantly writing back to Max Crawford particularly, and that hope was dashed when Crawford and others in the Melbourne department decided he was too unstable. The Canberra University College was formerly a college of the University of Melbourne, so once a year Manning Clark had to go down to Melbourne and to submit the examination papers, and normally misbehaved himself when he did. So they're the circumstances. They're the, in which he calls on radicals to give up their illusions and acknowledge that they were disabled by their adherence to what he described as an erstwhile great but now excessively rigid creed. For his part, Fitzpatrick had lost his part-time income as a journalist. He had a radio program and wrote in Smith's Weekly. He'd lost those in the 1940s. He'd tried repeatedly and unsuccessfully to obtain support that would allow him to continue his research. He'd tried repeatedly to obtain a university appointment, as I explained. In his papers you can find more than a dozen applications. And he had become convinced that he was blacklisted. My own situation, he told a friend after he was passed over for a post in economic history at Melbourne in 1957, is that I see no future. And reading his correspondence and his papers, I think he became deeply depressed. When his daughter Sheila in the early 1960s was considering an academic career, he sort of exercised the right to give paternal advice and told her that academics were, I'm quoting him again, superficially, as a rule, pleasant people, but quite incapable of rethinking or originating an interpretation, and naturally suspicious and resentful of anyone better endowed. In 1954, his friend, the Pacific historian Jim Davidson, suggested that he should seek a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation. This American foundation was very generous in its support of research activity in Australia. Its rules were that all applications had to come from universities, and indeed from university departments, so Fitzpatrick enlisted the support of Manning Clark as the head of the department at the Canberra University College. Clark declared himself to be a willing ally and assured Fitzpatrick that he was prepared to move heaven and earth to convince the Rockefeller Foundation of the merits of the proposal. And indeed he assured Brian Fitzpatrick of that by mail on the 15th of June 1954, and a long letter gave no hint at all of the views that he would declare just 8 days later in his inaugural lecture. 3 months later, Clark received a letter from the Vice President of the Rockefeller Foundation advising him that it would not be possible to include the project proposed by Brian Fitzpatrick in its program. Manning Clark sent what he called the sad letter on to Fitzpatrick, expressing the hope that it was not too big a blow. And he added the observation, did he perhaps think it would soften the blow, perhaps there is something to be said for not relying on these men of the jungle. Manning Clark was about to submit his own application to the Rockefeller Foundation to begin collecting materials for his history, and the men of the jungle didn't let him down. He got it. Similarly, when Jim Davidson then suggested to Fitzpatrick that he apply for a grant from the recently established Social Science Research Council, based in Canberra, both Davidson and Clark provided references for Fitzpatrick's application, and Davidson's were strongly supportive, Clark's more equivocal. I'm quoting again, I believe, though of course I cannot demonstrate it, that Mr. Fitzpatrick still has a creative mind. Now, on this occasion, the application succeeded, and Fitzpatrick enjoyed a modest stipend for 18 months. And it's a sort of it's an odd relationship. When Brian Fitzpatrick goes to Canberra, he usually stays with Manning Clark. Finally, and perhaps most disturbing at all, there's a short story that Clark published in Quadrant in 1962. In the late 1950s, early 1960s, He published a number of short stories which were gathered together under the title Disquiet and Other Stories. This one is called Portrait of a Free Thinker, and it has Clark's fictional alter ego, he's called Charles Hogan, as an undergraduate down at the Swanson Street Family Hotel, which was where Brian Fitzpatrick and his friends drank, and invited to dine with the legendary freelance scholar and wit, only to discover over dinner at the Café Latin, where Brian Fitzpatrick regularly dined, that he's boastful and vulgar and shabby. Now, this older man in the story is called Steve Parsons, and I think he's a composite figure. Some of his mannerisms and figures of speech are certainly not those of Fitzpatrick, but the resemblances, and I can explain them later on if you want, are disturbingly close. That hostile portrait clearly marked a change in the relationship. The younger man now occupied the position of authority, while Fitzpatrick had become the recipient of his patronage. But I think it also reveals Clark's egocentric preoccupation with his own experience. He was always sensitive to criticism, and he seemed oblivious to the damage that he could inflict with his judgments of others. Or perhaps he simply assumed an artistic license to tell of his own quest for grace, regardless of the consequences for the lost souls. Fitzpatrick did not shrink from criticism. On the contrary, he relished the exchange of polemics. But while he too could use mockery and ridicule in personal communications, in public disputation he held to the rules of combat with a very studied courtesy. Moreover, there was a popular maxim at that time, no enemies on the left. And he appreciated that Clark was still regarded with suspicion by many on the right. So if Manning Clark's erratic conduct tested his patience, he maintained the relationship. Your piece in Australian Signposts, that's the Association for Cultural Freedom book, your piece in Australian Signposts on rewriting Australian history is interesting, he wrote to Clark in Oxford. Clark was then in Oxford in late 1956, and Clark had written to Fitzpatrick. It was interesting, but I can't see where you're going. For my part, I deny optimism, infectious or chronic, at any time, and reject more strongly, with loathing indeed of the notion, that I was a disappointed radical when I wrote about Australian Labor. Although Fitzpatrick was distinctly unimpressed by Clark's account of his visit to the Soviet Union, Meeting Soviet Man, a book that has got him into a great deal of trouble, although Fitzpatrick was unimpressed by that book, he sent a message of succor when Clark was accused on its appearance of communist apologetics. He had little sympathy for what he described as Manning's clouds of errata and flaws and moles and mysticism, but he sprang almost instinctively to his defence when the bulletin controversialist M.H. Ellis attacked viciously the first volume of Clark's history. His only regret, he explained to a friend, was that he'd now have to read the book. You may recall, he said, Donald Horne's Observer attack on Manning's book on his Russian visit, which book I refrained from reading because I felt that Horne's illiberal comments, or some of them, sounded dreadfully apropos of Manning qua commentator on men and affairs. So he did read the book, and it confirmed his expectations. Again, writing to a friend, perhaps no harm will be done, and the book may last some time as a picture of Manning. May all the muses except Cleo bless him. But he made no public criticism of the book. For all of his difficulties, Fitzpatrick remained true to his code, and his constancy was surely remarkable because it went unreciprocated. Indeed, it was seldom acknowledged. When he wrote the message of support to Manning Clark during the controversy over the book Meeting Soviet Man, it was left to Don Baker, a colleague of Manning's in Canberra, to respond. Manning was very pleased to get your message. As you know, he's a diffident man, and it does him good to have things like this said about him. And Clark was diffident, and Fitzpatrick more robust. The older man suffered the greater disappointments, endured fiercer Cold War hostility, maintained his dignity in the face of all criticism, and never wavered from his loyalties. He died on the 3rd of September 1965. He was in Sydney, and his career was perhaps taking an upturn. He was collaborating with Ted Wheelwright on a study of foreign investment, and he was now getting some financial support to do so. He was working in Sydney, and Clark had recently spent time with him in the Mitchell Library. and wrote immediately after Fitzpatrick died to the widow Dorothy. I'm quoting from his letter. "My mind then moved on to what distinguished Brian from the others, indeed from all of us. It occurred to me then that, like my late father, he was held up by a hope that everyone one day would be nice to each other, that in their judgment of others they would use both charity and loving kindness. This gave a breadth to his vision of his task and made him in stature a giant." Now you can sort of catch from the prose there that Manning was beginning to inter Brian in the sort of mausoleum of his own concerns. And that was an appropriation that continued when he delivered the inaugural Brian Fitzpatrick Memorial Lecture at the University of Melbourne very late in 1965. Indeed, I was a first-year undergraduate, and it was the first time I'd heard Manning Clark speak. He was preparing the lecture, and he wrote to his son, Axel. Axel, also a history graduate, but went on to a distinguished career in literature. And this is what he said to Axel. "The prospect of talking on Fitzpatrick is a daunting one, but because of his affection for men and his sense, dim alas at times, of the mystery at the heart of things, I will do what I can to make him come alive again, and of course will speak warmly of his achievement. There is a never-ending war between men born with such clay and the great mass of humanity. Which side are we on? We must all take care unless we wound such a one by our monumental, pachydermal, suburban, conformist life." Not the normal letter from a father to a son, is it? The Brian Fitzpatrick Memorial Lecture sort of recalled a man of tragic grandeur. He said that he dreamed dreams about the future of humanity, that he looked to the past for the confirmation of his faith. And it also sort of played off a series of dualities. He characterised him as part Irish fancy and past Anglo-Saxon rigour, saint, larrikin, idealist, realist. And he placed particular emphasis, I recall, on the memory of his face, ravaged but not defeated. Fitzpatrick also appears in Clark's memoirs as a man of talent who became a heap of ruins. As it's explained, he's destroyed by Yarraside, the city of moral rectitude, but also by what came up from inside him. And by this time, the earlier criticisms or differences with Fitzpatrick had dropped away, and also the personal criticisms. In the late 1970s, when Robert Pascoe was conducting research for his book on the manufacture of Australian history, indeed it was the very first time that Manning Clark claimed to have been there the morning after Kristallnacht, Robert Pascoe, a young graduate student, spoke at length with Clark, and one night over drinks, he tackled him on the identity of Steve Parsons, that character in the Portrait of the Freethinker. And Clark denied vehemently that the character was based on Manning, on Brian Fitzpatrick. "I love that man," he insisted. Now, the differences between his understanding of history and that of Fitzpatrick could hardly be greater. One of them was a materialist, the other an idealist. Fitzpatrick was concerned with the class relationships and structures that shaped Australian development, the conflicts that they generated, the outcomes of attempts to change them. And Clark really wasn't interested in that. He took those relationships for granted, if you like, and he concentrated on a limited range of historical actors, treating others as little more than passive victims. But the two historians shared a striking similarity, one that was noted by Ken Inglis after he returned to Australia from postgraduate research in Britain, I think shortly before he took up an appointment here. And he'd been looking at Australian historical writing after he returned, and he said, wrote in a letter in fact to Ian Turner, that he'd been reading both of them. Both of them were genuine artists, he said, with a distinctive vision and a particular force of expression. And he went on to say, maybe it's the only genuine, slightly loony artists who can avoid dullness. Manning Clark, I think, signalled his dissatisfaction with orthodox scholarship in his Canberra lecture of 1954, and in the following year he completed his compilation, Select Documents in Australian History, and I'm sure a number of you like me will have used it. And it closes with this declaration. "So we leave them, dumbfounded at their optimism, astounded that belief in material progress and mateship could be their only comforters against earth and sky, man and beast." It's a fairly eloquent protest against the radical nationalist interpretation. In the following year, Brian Fitzpatrick concluded his Picture of Australian Life with a passage of similar charge. Here's how it goes. The Australian people made heroes of none and raised no idols except perhaps an outlaw, Ned Kelly, and Carbine a horse. But generation after generation, they fought with the beasts at Ephesus, blight and drought, fire and flood, their own taskmasters and the covetous aliens, and suffering their setbacks, still made of Australia a home good enough for men of modest report to live in, calling their souls their own. And in diction as well as judgment, that was surely a conscious riposte to his erratic friend. Thank you.